I knew that I had nowhere to go, and it seemed like no one loved me. They did, they just didn't want to see, they didn't want to witness what I was doing to myself.
Hey everybody, Doc Brian here, and welcome to Doc Talks, where we talk about people's troubles, trials, tribulations, and hopefully triumphs in life. Today we're in LifeWord Studios, broadcasting in 127 countries in over 175 languages to a potential listening audience of 2 billion people. You can find all of our content at lifeword.org. Today my guest has probably one of the best stories of grace and redemption that I've ever heard, ever known of. So we're excited to hear his story today. And so, David, thank you so much for being here with us today and your willingness to share your story.
I'm glad to be here.
Yeah. So first of all, right out the gate, you're about to be a dad.
I am.
You found out Saturday you're going to have a baby girl.
I am.
So just tell me what's going through your heart right now with that.
Oh, man, I tell you right now, I couldn't ever be so happier in my life. I tell you right now, so the feeling is it's overwhelming. Not overwhelming in a bad way, but
sure.
It's like I'm 41 years of age, and God's blessed me with the opportunity to become a father, and I have a beautiful wife and a loving family, and it's just a blessing.
Yeah, children are a blessing. You're getting a late start though, so make sure you stretch and all that kind of stuff before you go Little League and all that kind of stuff.
So, sure will.
So David, tell us a little bit about early life, growing up, the home, what your mom, your dad, siblings. Tell us a little bit about that dynamic.
Okay. My father is far, way back as I can remember, he was in and out of prison. We go back 36 years ago, when I was 5 years old. My father was in prison, and it's really like the beginning of the age where you start to remember things. It's kind of like, so the way this starts is me and, I had a 8-year-old brother, Aaron, and my brother, Daniel, he was about 6 months old. So we was getting off the school bus one afternoon, and we crossed the highway, and he decided he wanted to go back across the road and check the mail. Well, he asked me to hold his school books, and he went across the street to check the mail, but on his way back, he didn't check both sides of the road when he was crossing, and he got ran over, and I witnessed that, and it's something it's seared in my brain, seared in my memory, and it's just like a photographic memory, you know, something you'll never forget. It just gets easier with time, but so that's pretty much the beginning.
Now, how old were you when that took place?
I was 5 years old.
Five.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. So do you, you said you kind of have a photographic memory of what that was like. Was there ever a point of where, I know sometimes in intense trauma, we forget a lot of the details, and as we get older, things in life kind of bring those out. Was that your experience?
It seemed that I pretty much remembered the details from the time it happened and to this present day. And it's very vivid. It's very what you would call traumatizing. So yeah, the thing about it was that instead of them clearing me out of the way and getting me somewhere to where I didn't have to see, you know, anything that was going on around the scene, it was like I was there forever, and I was just there, you know, just staring at my brother's lifeless body, and for a 5-year-old, you know, that's damning, that's truly traumatizing, and it is my life. From that day would never be the same.
Yeah. Yeah, I, you know, back 20, 30 years ago, that wasn't the big thing to clear everybody out. It was, you know, let's work on the patient here. And, you know, modern day now, they would clear everybody out of the way. I've even seen them go as far as to put up tents around so that people couldn't see.
Mm-hmm.
Now, was your father in prison when
he
that
was.
Took place? So it was just you and your mother and then your younger brother. How did that dynamic change just in the house?
Oh, it changed everything dramatically. From that moment on, as far as I can remember, my mom started using excessively, drinking anything that she could to drown out the pain, you know, because I can remember her screaming as soon as it happened. And it was probably 100 yards from where we was at, from the front porch, of just all sharp gravel. And she ran down the road barefooted, and that's all I can remember. And from that day on, it was like life was just, it was just pure hell.
So to walk me through, if you remember, this may seem like a small detail, but the funeral as a five-year-old who has witnessed this trauma, what was that like for you?
So actually, because of when I was at the viewing, I literally tried to crawl into the casket with my brother and wake him up because I thought he was just asleep. So because of that and of how traumatizing it was, they didn't let me go to the funeral. And so that alone was just, it was a mess.
So even today, do you feel like there's closure there from that loss?
It took me a long time. It was actually our second cousin that had run him over.
Oh, wow.
She was in high school. She did everything she could to try to slam on the brakes because it's what caught my attention. And, I mean, so I held a grudge for a very, very long time. Just, you know, just holding a grudge, just all through my teenage years, just wondering, you know, I just couldn't let go. I couldn't let go and find peace with the situation because it's all that I knew. And because of that very beginning of my life, a traumatizing moment, I didn't know nothing but just to rebel against everyone and everything. So...
So what was that like, that rebellion, even as you know, an adolescent from 5 to 8 or 9 years old? What was that like?
It was, so they held me back in kindergarten because of the situation, because I had missed so much school. They held me back, and from that moment on to the age of 8 or 9, I was just complete disaster, in trouble at school every day, getting licks every day, if not suspended at a young age, kicked off the school bus, was being raised in a drug environment, alcohol in the house every night, parties, fights, never really a calm moment. And so that's all I knew from an early age. It was just, you know, not just alcohol, but just any kind of drug you could think of.
Yeah. So did your mom have an alcohol or drug issues prior to the loss of your brother?
Not that I could recall. No, not that I could recall. I mean, she may have used, but I wouldn't have known. But from that moment on, it just, it as I got older, I started seeing, you know, at the age of 7 or 8, you realize, you know, if you're in a house every night where there's a party with alcohol and fights involved, it literally becomes normal. And it's just what you're used to.
Yeah. Now, was your father in prison for drugs?
Actually, anything you could think of. Basically, he loved to run from the police. Anytime they try to pull him over, he was a Vietnam vet. So, you know, how that goes, he seemed to love to run from the police and give them any type of trouble he could, pump gas, not pay for it. Just basically, I mean, anything you could think of, my father did. I mean, he robbed a bank one time. He literally would do home invasions. He would actually even go to the, he would kick people's doors in at Christmas and steal all their gifts and their kids' gifts. And he didn't care.
So is your father still alive today?
He is not. My father committed suicide in 2007.
So you've had a lot of trauma.
Yes.
So to the point of your, in, within your adolescence, teenage years, was there ever an older male that kind of stepped in to try to, whether it was a positive or a negative role model, did you have that in your life?
Well, my mom had a series of boyfriends, you know, not to make it sound bad or anything, but there has been some male role models in my life, but basically it was short term, and I had to become the man of the house on my own. Basically, it was like short term here, you get used to one person, they're gone, and then you don't know what to look forward to after that. You know, it's just like hit after hit after hit.
So what was the dynamic there with your younger brother that was about 4 years younger than you?
Yes.
What was that like, taking over that man of the house role, having another boy in the house?
Well, he didn't know anything that had happened, so he really could never understand how it affected me as bad as it did. And I was very cruel to him. I was, you know, mean to him. I just picked on him, and, you know, basically he didn't have any better than I did. And I mean, now that I look back on it, I was a kid, but he grew up in the same environment I did. So basically we share a lot of the same stories, except for the very beginning, which, you know, to this day, he still doesn't quite understand how I could feel the way I do. You know, he feels like maybe you let it go, you should be over it, you know, but they just don't understand. You don't just get over something.
Sure,
like that.
Sure. So teenage years, is that where you really begin to rebel? Oh, yeah. Tell us a little bit about that.
Okay, from the age basically around 11, suspended from school 2 weeks at a time, fighting every day. Started drinking, which that was just the beginning. At 11 years old, I was placed in and out of behavioral centers, and it seemed to become just the life, like that's all I knew. In and out, Pinnacle Point, Methodist, Baptist. And it's like that I got so accustomed to it that that's all I knew. And when I got out, I would just mess up again so I could go back. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it was literally a mess. And I mean, was I putting my mom through hell? Of course I was. Mm-hmm. And I did not care.
Yeah. A lot of times, even with prison, people will try to get back in because that's where they feel the most safe. And was that kind of your experience, where that was the one place that you knew?
It was.
Yeah.
It was a safe haven. It was structured. It was the only thing normal in my life.
Yeah. And while that's sad to say, and I know that as a therapist, sometimes it's hard to put our children into therapeutic places. But in situations, that's the best place for them. Was there any one thing that pointed out in these behavior centers that, hey, I actually really may have a problem?
Towards me realizing that?
Yeah.
No, I was just a wild kid, and I didn't care what I done, who I was hurting. I was just on a path to nowhere, which eventually would lead to, you know, so many years spent in prison. So
tell us about the first time you got arrested.
Well, the first time I was arrested was about the age of 13. Me and another kid had jumped on a kid, and we beat him up. We broke his jaw. And it was over. It was senseless. It was over nothing. And, you know, and I was placed on juvenile probation. And from that day forward, at the age of 13, it was just, I mean, so the drug test, the visits, you know, them threatening me with DYS and all Division of Youth Services and all that, I still never cared. I would fail every drug test for pot. He would steadily send me back and forth to rehab, order me to go, and I would just go because I had to go. I never went because I actually wanted to change. I was just going to please my probation officer and to get out again and do the same thing. It's repetitive.
Did you ever feel like the purpose of continuing was because there was no possibility of it getting better?
Yes, it was just utter chaos. Nothing, it never seemed like there was ever going to be any happiness. And the drugs in the home continued, the drunkenness, everything, fights. And eventually I started skipping school. And, you know, before you know it, I mean, by the age of 15, my probation officer was fed up with it. He said, okay, I'm sending you to Division of Youth Services, which is juvenile prison, basically. And I went. I didn't have a choice. And it was some of the worst conditions that I've ever had to witness. You know.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, first of all, they place you there behind lock and fence. And that's when I really realized, hey, you know, I miss my family. I honestly, they place you there with every juvenile murderer, rapist, anything you could think of. It's in the juvenile setting you was there with. You were surrounded by them, and they did not care. All they wanted to do was fight. All they wanted to do was start riots. You know, of course, if you didn't stand up for yourself, you got picked on. It was just very rough conditions. The guards there, you witness them beat up the teenagers around you. And I mean, it's just grown men, literally at the time, that would just basically just beat these young guys senseless. And before the state took it over, it was private owned at the time. And it scared the living crap out of me. Yeah.
So fast forward a little bit, mm-hmm. when you get out, what happens then? Where do you go?
Well, I go back to my mother's house, of course, a million chances. I go back to my mother's, and I just, it's the same thing over. Kept smoking pot, kept running, staying out the streets late all night. Police bringing me home every night, that type of sort of thing. You fast forward a little bit. I stayed on juvenile probation until I was 18 years old. The day I turned 18 is the day that I got off juvenile probation. It took me about less than 90 days to catch my first felony as an adult.
And what was that?
Breaking and entering. Okay.
And do you remember why? Was there a why, or was it just?
There was no reason whatsoever. Pills, Xanax, whatever I could get my hands on, it makes you not have a care in the world. You could break into somewhere and there not be anything there, and you don't care. You just break into it. I mean, it was just something that I did, and it was just senseless, man. And I was placed on adult probation.
Yeah, I did a podcast several years ago with a guy that had an addiction issue, and his breaking point was he was high. He went into Target and he stole a wall clock for no reason. It's like, I put it under my shirt. Everybody could see it. And he said, for some reason, I thought I would get away with it, but I didn't even have a place to live. I didn't need a clock. And it made me realize that not always is it just about stealing something. It's about having the feeling that you are big enough to overcome even the smallest of maybe shoplifting. But if you have that addiction, it's not uncommon to do things to try to feel that addiction, whether it's that you steal something to sell to be able to buy drugs, or whether you break into somebody's house that you know has, you know, pills or whatever. Up to this point, you're smoking marijuana.
Yes.
You're drinking, and now you're to pills. Did your addiction end at pills?
No. No, I eventually found out what methamphetamine was, and that's where I met my maker. Literally gone crazy. I went crazy. I started where I would just smoke it a little bit, and then I could quit for months at a time. And then eventually I found out that, hey, I like doing this. It makes me feel whole. I feel like I'm actually living life. And I mean, and then I discovered what IV drugs would do. And when I did that, that was probably the worst part of it. Because the paranoid illusions, just stuff that you couldn't even imagine or fathom, I put people through. I feel like I'm jumping ahead a little bit. When I found out what methamphetamine would do for me, I had lost touch a little bit. What I done was, I burnt a house down, and there was no reason for this whatsoever. I burned a home down, and I was caught. They arrested me. They charged me with arson. They sent me to prison for the first time. So during my stay at prison, it seemed like that I hated it. I didn't want to be there. I never wanted to go back. But for some reason, I never could stay out. I never wanted to stop doing drugs. I never wanted to change my ways. Never wanted to look for something else, something greater. Over a 21-year span, I spent 17 years locked behind the Arkansas Department of Corrections.
A lot of times, I'm just backing up a little bit here. People begin to use meth, and it slows down their nervous system enough that they feel normal. You know, that, hey, this might be the answer. And it's not that you're wanting to use drugs or that you're seeking even the high of it. It's that life feels normal.
Mm-hmm.
But then you realize that you have to have more and more of it for life to be normal. And then you move to the intravenous, and then you have all of the, psychosis and, you know, audio and visual disillusionment and that. And sometimes that gets to the point of where people really get scared.
Yes.
About what's going on. Mm-hmm. But it's not enough for them to quit.
Exactly.
What was the point of where you realized, hey, I've got to quit doing this, but I can't. I need it.
Well, basically, I had become so paranoid and delusional that I would imagine some of the most craziest things, and I would accuse people of plotting on me or plotting to kill me. Deep inside, I wanted to stop. I wanted to stop, but I couldn't, because the only way that I felt normal was sticking a needle in my arm. It was the only normalcy that I felt. And I mean, so I feel like I'm kind of skipping around on the question.
It's okay. It's all right.
But I basically, anyone that had ever cared or ever tried to help me, I drove them away. Eventually, nobody wanted to be around. That one by one, they all started loving me from a distance. And that hurt even more. And once that started happening, I was like, well, I might as well keep getting high because now I don't have nothing. So you would basically choose to live couch to couch and on the street just to get your next high.
Yeah.
And not have a care in the world.
Because the needle was the one constant that was always there.
It was. Yeah. It was.
And looking back, you know, those people that distanced themselves, they didn't do that to hurt you. They did that to protect themselves of, we love him, but we don't want to enable him either. And we're doing this to protect our family. But I know, intellectually, I don't know firsthand, that for someone who's on drugs, that tough love sometimes is enough, but most of the time isn't. That you turn into using more and more and more. So tell us about the point, whether it was the 17 years, I believe you said, that you were in prison.
Mm-hmm.
Where was the point of where you said, I have a problem and something has to change?
Okay, well, I got locked up on a 90-day sanction, parole sanction, and I ended up serving 5 years of that until I went flat on parole. And when I got out of prison, I went on the meanest bender I had ever been on. And it would seem like I would keep getting subliminals, and you know, but I just couldn't, you know, understand it. I understood, but I didn't want to stop. I just wanted to keep going and going. Well, eventually it came to where my brother was like, look, man, you can't be here. You know, he basically looked me in my eyes and told me, excuse me. He said, I hate you. He said, I wish you was dead. And I was like, and you know, and I looked at my mom and it was cold. You know, it was just this, everything was cold towards me. And I was like, wow. And I knew that I had nowhere to go. And it seemed like no one loved me. They did. They just didn't want to see. They didn't want to witness what I was doing to myself. So me and my brother got in a scuffle and I put my hands on him and the police was called. And that day I was so out of my mind that I felt like the world was ending. I felt like there was all kinds of things happening that really wasn't, and it scared me to death. And the way that it looked when the police came and just found whatever reason they could to get me away from the only people that cared still, to get me away from there, I mean, it scared the crap out of me. And the coldness coming from my family that, you know, we're done with you, and that ride to the police station, that time, it was about 7 months after I did the 5-year sentence. And the whole 7 months, I was just on the bender the whole time, on the needle. I sit in the county jail for 25 days. And it's from the day that I went in, completely delusional, scared to death. I knew right then that something had to happen, something had to change. And I knew that it had to be, if I was going to change, it had to be through God. I would have to find my way to something different. I've always believed in God, but I had never had an encounter with what you would say, I guess, the Holy Spirit. So I started hearing about the program, a faith-based program. It's called Hope Alive. And so during this 25 days, I had a lot of time to reflect, and it was more reflection than I ever had in my whole life. So the day that they had released me, I walked to my brother's house, and And I walked in there like, you know, everything was fine. And I had it set in my heart that I wasn't going to use meth again. I did. But my brother looked at me and he said, "Brother, I love you, but you can't be here." He said, "You've been banned." Like, the apartments they lived in, I'd been barred. So I had nowhere to go. I didn't want to turn back to the drug that had absolutely almost ended me. So I said, "Okay, well, just give me one night to call Brother Danny Ward," which was the director of Hope Alive. I said, "Just let me reach out and see what I can do. Just give me 24 hours. And I mean, that right there, that day, that night, that was the turning point. Yeah.
Well, we're going to, as I mentioned, do a part two to this. So thank you for listening in today. I hope that you will tune in again to hear part two of this amazing story of hope and restoration. So thank you for listening today. Again, check out part two of this podcast with David Paladino, and I'm Doc Brian. You can find me at thedocbrian.com. Thank you for listening with us on LifeWord today. You can find all of our Christian content at lifeword.org. Thank you so much for being with us. Goodbye.